I'll call the meeting of the House Human Services, Finance, and Policy meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Jacob is going to be moving the approval of the minutes from February 13th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes that need to be made to the minutes? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from February 13th, 2025 are approved. Today we're going to start with a presentation from Director Grom for the Early Intensive Development and Behavioral Intervention Licensure Study. And so welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christy Grom and I'm the Director of State Government Relations at the Department of Human Services. Thank you so much for having us here today to talk about this study. So here to first talk a little bit about the legislative requirement that led to this study. We'll also touch on in this presentation what EIDBI is, or Early Intensive Developmental Behavioral Intervention. We'll talk about the process that DHS used for conducting our licensure evaluation, share the recommendations, and then also touch on the governor's budget recommendations as they relate to this topic. So in 2023, Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan recommended that the legislature require DHS to engage in a licensure evaluation. And that recommendation was funded and authorized by the legislature. And so since then, DHS has been working for the past couple of years with community partners on this evaluation. We knew this was not going to be an easy undertaking, so we spent a lot of time really devising an intentional plan. And the licensure evaluation was a three-part process that included pretty extensive community engagement. We did some national comparative analysis with other states. We looked at other services in DHS and really dove into, you know, what kind of services does EIDBI provide and is it a good candidate for a licensure? And then, of course, went into what were our final recommendations as it relates to either licensure or other regulatory oversight interventions. So EIDBI, taking a step back, is a state plan medical assistance service. It's authorized under our EPSDT benefit. And it was authorized back in 2013, implemented in about 2014, 2015. And this is a service that's really important to help keep kids in the community. So it can be provided in facility-based settings or clinics, but it also can be provided and often is provided in the community, in school settings, to make sure that kids are getting and families are getting the services right where they are. More specifically, so on this slide, you can see sort of the overarching intention of what EIDBI is, and that can be found in the authorizing statute, which I've also linked on this slide. But more specifically, for those of us who don't maybe have a clinical background or just feels like kind of an amorphous thing when we talk about EIDBI, wanted to talk a little bit about some of the specific therapeutic interventions that happen under this service. So some of the things that some of the services provided look like practical communication skills, supporting kids and families in being able to communicate, being able to interact socially. They address complex behavior. So for example, when children or youth have intellectual developmental disabilities or coupled with behavioral health concerns like mental health or SUD diagnoses, EIDBI provides services in those for those situations as well. They provide services related to self-regulation, improving cognitive functioning, and really importantly, safety skills. So we know that that's a critical skill for youth who have autism to make sure that they can stay safe and in their family homes. The last thing I want to say about background on autism or EIDBI is that this is a really critical service. We've seen an increasing need for this service in the community with the increasing rate of diagnoses in the community, increasing disparities, and the prevalence of autism in the community. So it's really critical that as we're thinking about licensure and regulatory oversight that we get it right. And that's why we spent a lot of time working on this evaluation, because kids and families need this service and we need to make sure that it's overseen properly and that there's all of the protections for health and safety in place. So you've probably heard, committee members have heard about applied behavior analysis and various modalities that we use in EIDBI. We've got six main modalities that are approved here in Minnesota. And so those are listed on this slide, applied behavior analysis or ABA, developmental individual difference, relationship-based, the Early Start Denver model, the Play Project, Relationship Development Intervention, and Early Social Interaction. Not all of these services are provided in Minnesota, but it's important to know that we do have the authority to allow providers to engage in services under these modalities. We also have the authority at DHS to add modalities. So this is a really quickly evolving service area. There's a lot of new research that's coming out every year, and we graciously have the authority from the legislature to be able to add different modalities to this list as new emerging evidence-based or promising practices arise. Within these modalities, EIDBI can be broken down a little bit more discreetly. So just for a kind of a brief primer for members, there are about six services or so that are provided under these modalities. So there's the evaluation or the comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation. We call that the CMDE. There's the ITP or the individual treatment plan, which is very common among other behavioral health services. So we want to, there's services to develop and monitor that ITP. There are coordinated care conferences, family caregiving, caregiver training and counseling, and then also really the crux of what is provided are intervention services. So on the individual level, on the group level, and then there's more intensive and also observation and direction. So that's just a snapshot of the services provided under EIDBI. Before jumping into the study, I did want to talk a little bit about the types of EIDBI providers and the supervision that's currently in place. So while EIDBI is not the service itself is not licensed, some of the providers that provide the service are required to be licensed. So for example, and each of these providers on this slide has different roles. They provide a different scope of services to each individual that receives the services. So the CMD that I mentioned, the evaluation is completed by a physician, an advanced practice registered nurse, or a mental health professional. The qualified supervising professional, or the QSP, is administered or provided by the physician, by a physician, an APRN, a developmental or behavioral pediatrician, or a licensed mental health professional. And then level one providers have 2,000 hours of clinical experience or training and the equivalent of a graduate level of coursework. And then levels two and three have various and sort of complex combinations of training and experience and education. All of those requirements are laid out in statute. The other thing of note is that all EIDBI provider organizations need one advanced certification provider. So that is a provider that is a QSP or level one provider, usually with the advanced certification in one of the treatment modalities that I mentioned in the previous slides. So there's various levels of oversight on the individual provider level, but here we're talking about really what is the oversight we need at the service level. Won't spend much time talking about this, but just wanted to note that QSPs, or the qualified supervising professional, accepts full responsibility to ensure that all of the people that they're supervising that are providing these services are providing services that are medically necessary, clinically appropriate, culturally relevant, that they're following the EIDBI agency's policies and procedures, that they're continuing to develop their knowledge, their skills, doing continuing education, and following all the treatment protocols with fidelity and integrity to the service model. So getting into the licensure study, so we've done this, as I mentioned before, segmented into three different phases. We've completed reports for each phase, though I will note that report wasn't required by the legislature, but we thought for transparency it would be helpful. This is a complex topic, and we wanted to show you all of the work that went behind these recommendations. So the first phase, which you can link to on your, if you're looking at your at this presentation virtually, is really a summary of all of the statutory requirements and the rules and policies related to EIDBI that's intended to inform sort of the community thinking and all of these discussions around the guidelines for regulation and monitoring of EIDBI. So really making sure that we're leveling the playing field, letting the community know, because it's not always intuitive and it is complex. We have complex health and human services systems. What the landscape looks like and how we are going to, make decisions about potential future licensing based on that landscape. So the second phase we completed in August of last year. This was a four-month process where we gathered, harvested community wisdom. We used surveys and focus groups. as part of this engagement process. And we really focused on two main constituent groups when we were doing outreach as a part of this phase. We focused on providers and professionals, as well as families and caregivers. And so the main objectives of this phase was to look at in EIDBI, what's working, what's not working, and what are the concrete recommendations that we should make for improving this service. And so some of the feedback you'll notice in the report isn't necessarily exclusive to licensure. So where there's been comments about, you know, there's struggles with getting access to EIDBI in schools, that's not something that licensure can address, but we did want to share that that's feedback that we received from the community. And as a department, we'll continue to work on that and would love to collaborate with all of you on some of those barriers that aren't specific to licensure regulation. And then the third phase is really the report that talks about, you know, we've done all of this work with community. We've scanned environments across DHS in Minnesota, across the nation, and we've identified as a department that we do recommend licensure for this service. And so really this report describes why licensure is needed and how it could address some of the current challenges that we're seeing right now. And then you'll note there's recommendations for both interim and long-term solutions to addressing some of the barriers. So why is licensure needed? Just diving down a little bit deeper into some of the rationale that we identified for why licensure is needed for this service. And I just want to note that licensure it's not a silver bullet. It's a minimum standard that really helps us to have a firm foundation to oversee basic health and safety and improve quality of service. It doesn't fix everything, but it is an important step in improving oversight of this service. So one of the things that we've seen is that clinical supervision was being stretched really thin in some cases, and we've seen that play out with safety concerns in the community. We've also noticed that some of the licensed professionals, those QSPs that I mentioned earlier, are affiliated with a lot of agencies. So they're doing the supervision, remember, of all of the individual professionals providing this critical service. And in some cases, those QSPs are being affiliated with up to 20 different centers. And that gives us some pause. We would prefer to see that lower, and we think that there might be some issues there in terms of supervision and what the appropriate number of centers to supervise would be and whether that's a clinically appropriate caseload for them. We've also noted that there are some providers that have out-of-state addresses. While we do allow telehealth under certain situations in EIDBI, there's guardrails around that. We want to make sure that when supervision is occurring, that there's a component of it, a proportion of it, and that's something we can discuss with the legislature, that is actually done on site, so that the qualified supervising professional or whoever the supervising professional is can really provide that hands-on guidance to the individuals that are providing this service. And lastly, we'll talk about this in the next slide, there's a growing number of provider agencies that are enrolling each month. That's corresponding to the growing need in the community, but when we have a growing service, sometimes there are growing pains, and we've seen that the number of advanced providers to supervise these agencies hasn't kept pace with the growth in the sector. So this is a slide that shows the growth in EIDBI providers, and I should note for members that both provider agencies, EIDBI agencies, are required to enroll at DHS, as are the individual providers. So this slide shows the individual providers that are that have enrolled, and you can see the sharp increase in those providers. The providers, I believe, have quadrupled over the past few years over the pandemic. And in terms of people that are enrolled and getting services, we've seen about a 30% increase growth in children and youth who are using this service. One thing lastly to note on this slide is that this rapid increase in EIDBI provider agencies and individuals has led to some operational inconsistencies. So we've talked with providers throughout the study, and what we've heard from them is that they want more training. They want to better understand the service. Some of them have gotten into this line of business very quickly, and they've said to DHS, we need more guidance, we need more education and training as it relates to delivering a high-quality service. So in summary, we recommend at DHS that EIDBI should be licensed. I should have stated this at the outset, but when EIDBI was first authorized by the legislature, it was challenging to get it across the finish line. I wasn't at DHS at the time, but I was in the other body, and there was a lot of opinions about what the service should be, how it should look, how it should be delivered, and the licensure of it wasn't able to be included as something that got across the finish line. And so over the years, we've been talking internally about the need for licensure, and certainly this study really culminated in our specific recommendations that we hope we can work with you on this session. So recommending that that we adopt a system of licensure to enhance the oversight, and really wanting to hone in on a balance of oversight and regulation, but also access to services. And that's something we heard loud and clear from the provider community, as well as individuals who use services. Some of the recommendations you'll see in the report are really focused on health and safety standards and tailoring those standards to the specific location where the services are being provided. There's a recommendation that DHS should be able to not just put standards in place, but be able to investigate, to report, and act on alleged violations of the standards that we put into law. And also some recommendations around clinical oversight requirements, provider supervision requirements. So I mentioned QSPs supervising many individuals, maybe taking a look at should there be a limit, and training requirements for providers. So moving to the governor's 2025 budget recommendations as they relate to EIDBI licensure, you've probably seen our change page and proposal on this, so wanted to talk a little bit more about it today here and connect some of the dots. So this proposal would create a provisional licensure that would allow some oversight while a full license is developed. So it will take some time to continue to work on developing those specific standards. There's a lot of work that goes into working with the clinical community, continuing to work with people who use services and families to make sure that we get those standards right. But for now, this proposal is just focusing on what can we do right in the immediate, and that is to provide a provisional license. So we would require providers to apply for a provisional licensure, I believe, by January. And so that's something that, should it pass this session and be funded, DHS would begin immediately in July working on getting that application started, as well as in concurrently working on the full licensure standards and getting those developed. So as part of this provisional licensure, DHS would be able to identify the controlling individuals, disqualify ineligible individuals. We would also be able to investigate maltreatment. So that's not something we have authority to do right now. That's left to local law enforcement. And it is, we found more beneficial for a state agency to do that type of maltreatment investigation, where we're sitting at a higher level and can sort of connect all of the dots in different ways than local law enforcement might be able to, but certainly partnering with them. And then lastly, we want to make sure that as a part of this provisional licensure that we're doing background studies prior to enrollment, and making sure that everyone has cleared those background studies and we're crystal clear that those health and safety standards are strong. So roadmap to licensure, I mentioned that a provisional licensure is our first step that we're recommending, but there's a lot of work in the next few years that we need to do, so we need to continue to engage with community, design the licensing requirements. We'll need to upgrade our systems, and we'll need to hire staff and make sure that they're able to review applications, conduct on-site reviews and investigations. Wanted to show you what we were thinking about in terms of a potential timeline. I will say that this is probably a pretty aggressive timeline, but we do understand the critical need for beginning licensure and oversight as soon as possible. So should this legislature authorize licensure, we would know that presumably at the end of May, and we would begin working on full licensure and getting our application started right in July. In 2027, as part of the governor's proposal, we would like to come back and provide recommendations to the legislature and specific language about the full licensure framework and what those standards would be, and work with you all at that time to refine those, polish them, and make sure they work for you and for the community. And then should that pass in July, we would be able to potentially start implementing as soon as 2028. So that's pretty quick timeline, but we think we can do it with your support. And would love to have further conversations this session on this idea. In addition to licensure, I did just want to note a few things in our proposal this year that aren't necessarily tied to licensure, but are also important for regulation and oversight of this service. So CMS categorizes provider types into three different categories. So there's a low risk, moderate risk, and a high risk. Right now, EIDBI providers are categorized at a moderate risk, and this proposal would move them to that high risk category, and that would in turn make sure that there's enhanced screening prior to a provider being enrolled, and it would make sure that their revalidations are when we check on them through provider enrollment and go through our checklist, make sure they're meeting all the basic requirements. Instead of checking on them every 5 years, a high-risk provider would get a visit every 3 years. And then lastly, I've noted also previous to this that this would clarify that DHS is the investigative agency for maltreatment. So that's our pretty quick overview of the licensure study. I know members have the whole study in their packets. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Director Crum, for your presentation this morning. Are there questions for the director about this report? Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for your presentation. I'm glad that we are going to be taking a look at this. I'm just going to just talk about a couple of things that I'm concerned about and then also ask a couple of questions if you don't mind. So just seeing from 2017, the claims being $1.7 million, you know, jumping a couple of years, upping it to $55 million, and then in 2023 paying out $400 million. I'm curious if in that amount of time from 2017 to that jump to 2023, I can't remember hearing this presentation or hearing anything about this in 2023, but did you find with that drastic uptick in payouts and just growth in the number of children needing services, was that also brought forward to us last year? That was one question I had.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't recall that we've talked specifically about EIDBI growth in the previous session, but we may have. I would have to go back and look at all the hearings. I mean, it's something that the growth has been something that we've been aware of throughout the pandemic and informed about from our policy staff.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, thank you so much. And then just looking to, you know, just understanding that there being 29 open investigations on the EIDBI, there we go, it's early in the morning. Just wondering, is there any way to speed up this timeline, or is that where you're at with timeline? That's what you guys could do this year because there's so much opportunity for fraud in this wheelhouse.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, that's a great question. We've went back and forth with our team to identify the quickest timeline that we could identify. That being said, we've been, you know, noticing and concerned, highly concerned about the, you know, potential fraud as well. And we've took it upon ourselves to investigate agencies. So we've done about investigations of about 160 agencies. Maybe investigations is the wrong word, I should reframe. It's our staff, our licensing staff, and our fraud staff going out and really going on site to the agency and talking with the staff and making sure, seeing what their processes are that they have in place and making sure that they're providing services and delivering them in a appropriate manner, that they're billing for those services in appropriate manner, and that there's no indications of fraud or concerns there. So we've done that for 160 agencies, and we are embarking. We've really not encountered a lot in those site visits, but we have referred a few issues to the appropriate authorities in those cases. And we are now embarking on another segment of the EIDBI provider population to go and investigate those settings as well. So while this timeline does feel long, we are doing what we can internally to go and do on-site investigations and oversee what's happening there.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. And then one last question I have, Chair and Commissioner, Director, there we go. Is the growth of the EIDBI care matching the number of children with ASD in the state of Minnesota?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I would want to dig into the data a little bit more. What I presented today was that the provider growth was about quadrupled, whereas the children receiving services was about a 30% increase. So that while that's not equal, I think I'd want to make sure that I've got access to current data and how many providers with that provider growth. I believe that's individual providers, and each of those individual providers has a different role in the service delivery. So while those aren't equal, I think there's an argument to be made that it could be commensurate with the growth of children, depending on how those services are delivered in each individual agency and the needs of the individual child.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So on page 11, you talk about taking the authority away from state and local government. And could you explain the rationale how moving away from local control, how you would know better for locals when you're kind of farther up the chain? Can you explain your rationale for that when you're farther removed from the local government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, this has been something that's been raised with our provider community and with people who use services and families as a recommendation. And it is commonplace in DHS for our licensed programs where we have the ability to investigate a maltreatment investigation or claim. Allegation. So this isn't taking away local control. We would still continue. We have solid relationships with our local law enforcement, with our attorney general and others in the state. We would still collaborate with them, but it would give DHS the ability to investigate those maltreatment investigations. So for example, last spring, I think it was, we saw some really horrible practices where a child was being physically abused. Child who's getting EIDBI services. In that situation, DHS was not able to intervene and investigate the maltreatment and support those investigations. Eventually, that employee was subject to, I believe, criminal penalties, but we want to make sure that we have the ability to intervene as soon as possible. It's not that we think that we know more, but we do have a broader view in terms of all the provider types and have kind of an ongoing relationship with them through our various provider enrollment processes.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah, well, I certainly have concerns with giving more authority to higher levels of government over local control. And I think my second concern is that coming from county commissioner's standpoint, so many of these duties that the state wants to take on, fast forward 10 or 15 years down the road, and now you're offloading that back onto the county, and it becomes an unfunded mandate onto property taxes. So I just feel like this is a stepping stone to going in a bad direction. I don't know if you'd have a comment on that.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that feedback. I think we've made great effort to align our recommendations with what we've heard from the many providers that we've worked with on this evaluation of what the recommendation should be, as well as people, children, and parents who use services.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at page 9, you just said that it's about four times higher, but actually from 2020 to 2024, how the number of providers increased 10 times, went from about 1,200 to 12,000, but yet the number of people that were servicing only went up 30%. I guess my question for you with that is that are all providers audited? I mean, we've had this great increase in providers, or are they spot checked to come up with the 29 investigations?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, excellent question. So at DHS, we have various ways of surveying whether or not fraud might be occurring or whether we're identifying concerning patterns and billing, for example. And we do take tips and complaints, as you mentioned, but we also have systems in place that look at, what's happening with different claims and at particular provider types. So we are doing both. We're taking tips and complaints, and then we're also looking, using different systems that are required through CMS to assess patterns and where there's concerns.
Representative Murphy.
It just looks like to me that this could just be the tip of the iceberg. You know, we don't really know what this entails, but it's really an interesting number to have 10 times more providers with only a 30% increase in users? Really? So I'd be really interested in how that's going to be measured and whether we have a system in place that actually looks at auditing our providers to make sure that, you know, we're getting a good taxpayer value for, you know, the dollars that we're spending on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Good morning. Thank you for coming and presenting. I have a question in regards to how quickly can DHS act on violations under the proposed licensing?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, can you reframe your question? Is it how fast, like what the time period is for DHS to
act on violations, yeah, investigate?
See.
Mr. Chair, Director Representative, I don't have that information. I would have to get back to you, but I'm happy to do that.
Okay.
Representative Hiltzley.
Just one more. Thank you, Chair. How will DHS determine the classified high-risk providers? What additional oversight measures will be in place to do that?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so my understanding of our proposal is to move all EADBI provider agencies from moderate to high risk, so we aren't identifying specific providers. It would just be a change altogether in that provider type.
Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, any other questions? Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is a little like your question. When we have five different provider types and we bring in licensure, I understand maybe the licensure applies to the supervisor of that agency, or will each of these five types be required to have some level of licensure in the new paradigm that we're going to?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the agency itself will have standards, so the owner, the operators of the agency will be subject to, would be subject to these licensure standards that we're proposing. Both in the provisional, from the provisional licensure, and if we were to enact full licensure standards, and each of the individual providers may have a professional license. So, for example, similar to mental health services, where we have, you know, a license under in Chapter 245I for that entire provider, and it says these are the specific standards. Within that, we have mental health professionals, licensed psychologists, or licensed independent clinical social workers that hold their own professional license. So it will be both. So this will be an enhancement to make sure that we're covering more ground and that DHS has the ability to oversee that and not just rely on our professional boards. We have made referrals where we've seen concerns over the years to professional boards, like our Board of Psychology, for example. And in some cases, we haven't always seen how those boards have reacted to the concerns that we've had. So we want to make sure that we are able to take some ownership of that and oversee those health and safety protections.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One additional question. In addition to licensure, that would create a framework by which we qualify providers and make sure they're well qualified, both professionally as well as criminally and all these other ways. Is there a way that we can somehow a little bit more so standardize treatment? Is that tucked into here with licensure? We cannot cookie cutter this. I mean, this is not an easy thing. We have multiple approaches. We have it happening in schools, younger, older, so we can't have a simple cookie cutter scenario, but we could some way come with treatment protocols customized to a diagnosis, customized, that might also, in this conversation, bring some uniformity and arguably credibility and cost containment along with the good outcomes that we're going for. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any follow-up on that, Director?
That is a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that highlights something that's important to know about the work of DHS. So when we're looking at regulations and oversight, we've got a Office of Inspector General with our licensors, folks that are looking at program integrity, and while they're doing their work and recommending changes to improve the service, they're also working with our policy team, where we have a lot of clinicians who really understand just the thing that you're talking about. What is the appropriate service? What is the evidence that this is a service that's going to lead to a good outcome? And so we're really coupling that work and making sure that we're making licensing or oversight recommendations. We're also looking at, in the policy statute, should there be clinical, just different clinical considerations or requirements. So I think they're a little bit separate, but definitely related. And if you want to dive into this, we have a lot of clinicians on staff that would love to talk to you more about that. We also partner closely with the University of Minnesota and all of the research that they're doing in this area.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm good.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director Graham, for being here and explaining what's happening in the area. One of the questions I have is, when I was taking a look and saw the growth in the number of providers out there, I was wondering what percentage of them are not currently active anymore. I noticed one of the recommendations was that we be trying to put in a provision to remove inactive ones, so I'm curious as how much of that number is inactive currently.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, there are numbers in the report, and I don't have them off the top of my head, and I think they might be a little bit outdated, but there is a fairly significant proportion of those providers that are inactive. And so I think that is one of the parts of this proposal, is to make sure that if providers aren't providing services in the past year or so, that we're able to take them off our books and focus on the providers that are indeed providing the services. I think important point. Thank you for raising it.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. That kind of leads to the next question as well. We see that big growth in the number of providers, and we know that there's been a growth in the number of billings out there. Be curious to see what is the actual growth in terms of active in each year. In other words, is there a way that could be diced out so that when we're looking at the numbers, we're seeing the cumulative numbers, including those that are inactive, but each year, those numbers are somewhat lower by those who are actually doing the billing, doing the work, versus those who are not doing anything. And then one other question is there a lot of turnover in providers? Do they work shorter periods of time or do they work longer periods of time? What I'm thinking of is, do you have folks that might be doing it during the summer between breaks in college or something? You hear what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. Is how much of that is causing some of the growth? I'm just trying to dive down a little deeper into it. Thank you.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, excellent questions. I do think we should go back and take a look at data and how we could maybe reformat it to show what the growth is based on just providers that are active in the past year. We can certainly follow up with that information for you and for the committee. In terms of workforce trends, we have done a lot of analysis at DHS, and we have found that there is a significant workforce shortage in this area. So while we've talked about, yes, the number of providers increasing, some of that is due to trying to recruit and get more providers to deliver this really critical service in the community. And like any other human service, we do see a lot of turnover in this area. Probably I would venture to guess, but I would have to confirm more in the kind of level 2 and 3 provider types, which are, you know, while they aren't necessarily licensed, that's an important part of delivering this service. And so we do see that turnover that could lead to some of the growth. You're correct. And sorry if I missed one of your questions in there.
Representative Fisher. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director Grum. The question that kind of leads into, and I think this is where your report is getting at, is as we're going forward, if there's a lot of turnover occurring, how that impacts as training is going forward, is because our people, we want people trained and in. Will that help maybe cause people to stay longer instead of some of the churn that's going out there? And I know that part of it is we've got labor shortage. Part of it comes down to pay. But I can also see that as it's standardized, it maybe gives a little bit more professionalism and maybe people will stay longer too. Just some thoughts along those lines. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions, and sorry, this area is new to me. So you have individual providers and then like the agency, right? Are those individual providers independent contractors? Are they employees of the overarching agency, both?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernig, there is a requirement in statute that has some ambiguity around it as to whether these employees, whether these providers should be, are required to be employees or if they can be contractors. We have seen that in many cases these are contracted employees, and this governor's proposal would clarify that the policy and the EIDBI statute Section 256B, to make it crystal clear that that providers, that these workers do need to be employees of the agency. So that's something that we think would add some clarity and better oversight to this service.
Thank you. I have another question, if that's okay.
Representative Vernick.
Thank you. To Representative Jacob, your point earlier about local control versus state agency, and I get that as I've worked for a county for many years. So one of the questions I have is if there is an issue with abuse in EIDBI right now, when you call that in or however that process works, does the county currently investigate that, or how is that done? And then if the licensing is by the state, but the investigation of maltreatment is by the county, how does that work?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I could probably get you better information following this hearing, but it's my understanding that that local law enforcement does those investigations, not counties. I could be wrong about that, but I can confirm. So it's not even that counties are doing the investigations where they would, for example, you know, child protection allegations. So this is quite of an outlier in terms of our human services in Minnesota.
Representative Vernick.
Yeah, so would clarifying language need to be implemented if the authority was more with the county versus the state? And then if there's an issue being found, can the county, you know, remove somebody from the program, a provider from the program, or would that have to go to the state? I guess I'm just trying to understand where the authority lies if it stays with the county versus the state.
Director Grum.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would really need to go back to our experts and understand more about how that interplay works. We counties are important partners, so whatever we're doing here, we would want to work with our county partners. We have talked with them about this proposal and want to make sure that where they're identifying issues on the ground and we may not see it, that there's a collaborative process and an exchange of information so that we can work together.
Representative Vernick. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, just a quick question. Has there been a shift of a recipient receiving EIDBI from other programs like BCA or anything? Are you tracking the shift from one program to the other?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I'm actually not sure about that. I would have to get back to you, but I do know that as part of kind of the governor's, you know, our enhanced oversight right now that we're doing surveillance of this community, we are trying to connect the dots and understand where, for example, if there was a payment withhold in one sector and that same provider is providing various services, that we're looking at that provider and the full scope of services that they're providing and making sure that we've got eyes on all of those service lines.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director Grum, are we tracking the quality of service that the individuals or the recipients are receiving? Because this is a really critical program for a vulnerable participants. When you look at the modalities of treatment, we've got the QSPs performing some of that services, but we also have the BCBA. And last year we implemented licensure for BCBA. Are they also working from home or even outside? You know, we talked about independent contract. I think that question will be coming up soon. So the issue is those qualified individuals, are they held accountable to the services and outcome for the kids who are receiving the service?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, it's my understanding at this time they are not largely held accountable because we don't have licensure in place. So there are different ways that agencies probably assess effectiveness of services and outcomes, but there's nothing in state law that requires them to. And so I think that's part of the impetus of the governor's budget recommendations in this aspect, is to make sure that we're putting some very basic standards in place and expecting that you know, that providers are reporting those outcomes to all of us.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director Grum, do we have qualification requirement for the controlling entities so that they are qualified for the service that they're providing?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I mean, we have qualifications that are required for for the particular providers, but if you're referring to the owners of the program, I don't know. I would have to get back to you.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, Director Grum, does the commissioner right now, before we start the provisional licensure, have the authority to put moratorium until we have got that set up going?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, we don't have authority in law to impose a moratorium, though that has been a discussion we've had in the agency, given the growth in this sector, and given, you know, if we are to embark on a provisional licensure, to make sure that we're setting realistic parameters for ourselves, so that we're dealing, maybe taking those providers that aren't active right now off the books and focusing on the providers that we have right now, getting them on that provisional licensure, and then moving forward and assessing if we need more providers in this area. There are many other provider types that have moratoriums in place, and the legislature could choose to do that here.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, the last question. So with the inherent authority of the commissioner, can that be implemented as we go through this conversation, this session?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, and Rep. Knorr, could you repeat that?
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, if we don't have legislation right now, with the authority of the commissioner under the law, can that be implemented briefly until we are able to get that provisional license?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I think we would need to assess the, you know, potential legal risk with us making that change, but we would prefer that to have specific authority in law, like the other service lines that have moratoriums in place, to make sure that we're implementing any change as is directed by the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Director Grum.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Grum. I'm just looking at, you know, the 30% increase there, and looking at page 4 where there's a list of the treatment modalities, and then it says here that, you know, that other modalities can be added and approved as the commissioner sees fit, it looks like. What do you contribute the rise in the growth to, and is this a complete list of modalities?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll start with the modalities because that was the most clear question to me. This is the complete list that's in the statute in 256B0949. And if we were to add more services, there's a process for that. But it's my understanding this is the complete list that's authorized right now. Not all of these services are even used in Minnesota, but there's options for people and providers. And when you asked to clarify your previous question, are you asking about why is there a growth in the 30% growth in individuals who use autism services? Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a variety of reasons probably for that growth, one being early intervention. The service itself is called Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention, and really it's focused on making sure that we're able to have touch points and intervene with children and families as early as possible, because there's specific developmental windows that if you miss those windows, you will not get the same kinds of outcomes had you intervened sooner. So one, earlier intervention. Two, I would just say, you know, we've seen services being offered more in schools and other settings, so people have more access to getting diagnoses. And certainly there's a rise in autism that I think is being widely studied. The CDC has an ongoing study that Minnesota is a part of to really understand what's going on in the community and why we're seeing these increases in prevalence of autism. So there are a variety of reasons, I would say.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I had.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director. So a quick question on the Level 2 and Level 3 providers. Mm-hmm. Curious, can guardians, parents, or foster parents, could they qualify and receive Medicaid reimbursement for providing those services for
Director
children?
Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I don't believe that that's the case. These are not parents of minors or guardians that are providing those services.
Representative Gilman.
And then also, thank you, Chair, for just follow up around that. So then the governor's proposal would basically be taking away any independent contractors and then creating a system that would be just solely based in DHS. Or they'd have to be then, they couldn't be an independent contractor, they'd have to be employed by an agency, is that correct?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, there might be some caveats to that requirement, but generally, yes, that is correct. And that is what we believe and what we've heard from the legislature was actually the intent of this language to begin with when the statute was authorized. So I think we just need to make sure that there's some clarifications to make sure we're aligning with that intent. And my understanding is that the rise in independent contractors has really correlated with the increases that we've seen over the pandemic. So it's been a new phenomenon that we've seen that we're trying to address in partnership with all of you.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, thank you so much.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, thank you, Representative Gilman, because that's kind of where I was going. I just need some clarification. So, Director Grum, what you're saying is that we do have independent contractors at this point in time in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, yes.
No. Representative Keeler.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So that brings up concerns for a couple reasons, mainly in how we process background checks. And we've talked in, I think it's this this committee that has jurisdiction over backgrounds. And we know that there's a massive delay with the high turnover that we have, and then people are waiting. I guess, can you explain to me what the difference in the background studies are? Because this is I worry about who's spending time with our most vulnerable kids in a supportive way. I think we all should be worried about that. And are our independent contractors having to go through less of that background rigor than individuals who are coming through on the state capacity? That would be my first question, and I do have a follow-up.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I don't think we have our staff here from background studies. I can confirm, but it's my understanding that all providers have a background check. But right now, the way that EIDBI providers are classified, that background check can occur concurrently to them providing services. So the change in the governor's budget would allow that, would require that check to happen before they actually deliver the services and are fully enrolled.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I think that leads to the next question is, because sometimes there's this lag in getting information back on background checks, is that because we're in this critical time frame that we need individuals in to provide the support systems, there seems to be this issue happening where somebody completes their background check, we allow them to start working in the services, and then we get their background check and we find out that they shouldn't be working with our kids at all. So how can you confirm with us that that's not happening to our kids, and if there's areas of policy that this committee needs to work on to make sure that doesn't happen? I understand that we don't want to not have people in those positions, but I really think that having harmful people in those positions would be worse. So can you tell us where we are with making sure that that never happens, or if there's policy that we need to address here to keep our kids safe in that capacity?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I think that's a really important point that you make. We do need to balance that kind of oversight with access to services, but we want to make sure first and foremost that safety is the cornerstone of what we're doing. My understanding of the governor's proposal is this change where we're requiring providers to completely clear the background check that we're including in this proposal would address that safety gap that you're talking about. I know the way background studies work right now is usually you get a preliminary letter from DHS in some cases, and it might say, like, there's some issues here, you can provide services, but only when they're overseen by, you know, your entire, all of your work is overseen by another professional. And so with this change, we would be making sure that before anyone provides the actual service, that the background study is fully cleared.
Representative Keeler.
That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director. Just going off of the line from Representative Keller's line of thought, protecting our most vulnerable, I'm wondering, Director, we have talked a lot about turnovers, and in the same breath, we've also talked about the increase in need of those critical services. Is there a process where DHS can protect, can prevent individuals implicated in past Medicaid fraud from operating an EIDBI center. Basically, do not go back and start another agency while they are either going through an investigation or have already been indicted. Just curious. Thank you.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hiltzley, I believe that that is part of the provider enrollment process, that we will not enroll a provider that has that's actively, you know, under investigation. I can get you the specifics about those requirements. I do know that the governor's budget more broadly, not this proposal, does include enhanced protections in that sense so that we can make sure we're disqualifying or not enrolling people from the beginning. And I think prevention is really key for us as well. We have other Medicaid services that that go through, you know, for example, PCA. There's a program called the Steps for Success Training. And that service, that training is a training that's done by DHS in collaboration with the Attorney General's Office, with the Department of Labor, to make sure that providers have all of the education and information up front before they even get enrolled. It's a requirement of enrollment that they know how to bill properly, that they understand what the requirements are in law. And that they understand what fraud is. And a lot of times providers aren't trying to commit fraud, but they're making mistakes, and those can, when they're not addressed, can escalate and turn into, you know, something that we would consider more fraudulent criminal behavior. And so it is really key for us to look at prevention. I'd be happy to talk with you more about some of those ideas and where we can expound on what I presented here today.
Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, you mentioned the steps for success in PCA. Is there a plan for training within the proposals that we will be seeing?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, in the provisional licensure part of the proposal that we're bringing forward, I don't believe we have any training requirements. We're really trying to get at those kind of core safety needs related to maltreatment. But if there are ideas that you and colleagues here in this committee have, we would love to work with you and to integrate those ideas into this proposal. We have had discussions internally at DHS about, you know, EIDBI is really a service that we believe should move to licensure, but there's other unlicensed services that probably licensure isn't warranted. And we do think that maybe this could be a space where we might want to do a similar training that we do under PCA, for example, for both EIDBI and other unlicensed services.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, can we develop a standard whereby everyone who is enrolled for programs can get basic training, that everyone who is enrolled know what they're doing so they can be informed and get also continuous education? Is there a plan to develop something like that in the future?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, there is absolutely a plan. So in all of our licensed services, there are specific training requirements. Sometimes the legislature adds to those in various service lines. And so that is the plan with full licensure. And it's possible that we could even add something sooner than that. If you all would like, we can work with you on technical assistance and listen to more of your ideas.
Representative Knorr.
My final question, in terms of ensuring that the recipients also understand, you know, whether their parents or whoever is receiving services, that they are informed about their rights and responsibilities as part of the training component when they are given, you know, when they are made eligible for the programs. Do we have something in place, not only the providers, but also the recipients can get the same information?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I'm not aware of what kinds of you know, informed consent or forms are given to parents. I would imagine there are some right now, but if there's gaps there, we would be very happy to work with you on addressing those.
Representative Knorr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Chair and Director. I have a question. So when we were on page 7 and you were talking about the three different phases, at one point you said they struggled accessing this in schools. And so I looked through the report, and I sit on Ed Finance, education, former school board member. So I'm kind of like, how does that interplay look? Was that addressed in the report? I didn't see it, but I also don't have my computer to do like seek and find schools. Was it addressed in the report? And if so, could you give me an overview of what that looks like? If not, why not?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernick, that's a great question. It is, there is some basic information in the report. I don't think it's super detailed. I can go back and point you to that, but I believe it, what I'm remembering is that there was just some issues with, and it would kind of varied by school district. So I think there was some uniformity issues in how EADBI is accessed in schools depending on the district, but would be happy to dig into that and also connect you with community partners who raised those concerns.
Representative Vernick.
Thank you. Do you see schools playing a bigger role in this going forward as part of the plan, or scaling back and having it not in schools?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernick, at DHS and you know, the foundation of this service is that it's provided in the home and the community. And so we do think that services offered in schools are very valuable to students and to families. So for example, when a parent has to take off of work to and maybe find transportation to go and pick up their child midday, disrupt their coursework, bring them to an appointment outside of the school, it's just not the most seamless way to deliver services. And it also could be associated with, you know, a child being stigmatized in some way. So we do, as much as possible, would want to co-locate services in schools.
Representative Vernick.
Okay, final question, sorry. So if that's the case, and I don't have the governor's budget plan memorized, but is there a line item to help fund that more if the goal is to maybe have some of those services more co-located in schools?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernick, services provided in schools right now are typically, they're provided under Medicaid and they're reimbursed. I guess it kind of varies a little bit, so I might get a little bit out of my depths here because there's different reimbursement structures under MA IEP services, but typically they are reimbursed under Medicaid, so there's not, there wouldn't be a need to increase that reimbursement as it exists today unless there's, you know, identified issues with the current EADBI reimbursement. But I think that that particular issue that came up in our conversations with community is something that we want to dig into and really understand from schools and from parents what those barriers are. Maybe reimbursement is part of the barrier.
Representative Vernick. Okay, thank you. Director Grum, in the report there were a few red flags that the study found, one being the example of the child who was getting 40 hours per week of care that may have been more, I think the report said something like it may have been actually child care, but it was billed under EIDBI for those things. And then instances where the person answering the telephone wasn't answered in a, seemed more of a local type of answer, or private emails being used. The examples that were in this report, were those kind of just one-off flags, or were there a handful of cases where it was similar pieces, or was this more of a giant red flag and a bigger concern in there? What level or what scale were these examples in the report?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. I think while I don't have sort of, you know, how many settings did we look at in under the, you know, the incidents you're talking about, and so out of how many settings did we identify these concerns, but I would say any of the settings that we identify in them is a concern to us, whether or not, you know, if we need to make sure that these are really critical services that are supporting children and families who have some significant issues. And so from our perspective, no matter the scale, we do want to intervene and understand what can we do as a state, as a department, to have better oversight and improve the quality of these services.
Thank you. It also, the report also noted that the use of telehealth grew after the pandemic. Is there any, I guess, speculation as to why that growth happened after, if it was just the opportunity was there to do that then versus earlier, or anything that wasn't in the report that the department has or is maybe addressing in the governor's proposal?
Mr. Chair, as you know, many services delivered via telehealth grew, were delivered more and more via telehealth during the pandemic. So I think that that's sort of the general reason that we would point to. We do have requirements in EIDBI when telehealth can be provided. So we've got some guardrails around it. But I think one of the things that we'll want to look at with this committee and with the legislature is, should there be a prohibition or should there be a requirement that providers are located in the state of Minnesota? For some services, we have that requirement. For example, community first services and supports. When we're thinking about when we enroll consultation service providers, for example, we require in their contracts that they have at least an address in Minnesota. And when we hear that there isn't one, that raises a red flag for us, and we go out and we check in to see what's going on and if they're meeting the requirements of those contracts. So I think that that's something that we should look at in terms of people that are providing services from outside of Minnesota.
Thank you, Director Grumman. And my understanding with that is that most of the out-of-state were border states, but that there were some that were hours away by flight even to get here. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Final question for me, Director, is there any CMS guidance that you're receiving on any of this to be helpful or not helpful, as it were, that may be good for us to consider when proposing legislation?
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to follow up and provide some more information, but I know that our Office of Inspector General has been engaged in national conversations with other states. CMS has been a part of those conversations, and they have identified an uptick in concerns around providers in this sector. So we are working with CMS and working with other states to understand, what are they doing? What kinds of issues are they having? Are they similar to the ones that we're having? Are we sharing, or do we have a provider in another state where there's maybe, allegations of fraud or improper billing? And is that provider also providing services in Minnesota? So we're doing our best to do that outreach and be happy to share with you more from what CMS has shared with us.
Thank you. Any other questions for Director Grom? She promised us 45 minutes and gave us well more than that. So thank you for your presentation today, and thank you to the committee for your interest in this topic as we move forward. Next on the agenda is bringing back the commissioner to continue the conversation we had to conclude last week on the governor's budget proposals. We have their presentation, and so this is just the rest of the hearing time today is just for further questions to get some points on the record and maybe even influence the revised budget when that comes up, fingers crossed. So as they get settled in, if anyone has any questions, just let me know.
Excuse me.
Whenever you're ready, welcome back to the committee, and when you're ready, introduce yourself for the record so we get that out of the way, and then we'll go into questions.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. For the record, my name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm currently serving as temporary commissioner for the Department of Human Services. Also with me today are colleagues Assistant Commissioner Mers and Director Bailey.
All right, thank you. First on the list, Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So back when you came before the Legislative Audit Committee, we talked about the $40 million that in fraud that was uncovered. And first question is what's your response and why there's no effort to recover that?
Director Gandhi.
Chair, Representative Jacob, can you share a little bit more about that information? I wasn't specifically in a legislative audit committee.
Well,
Representative Jacob.
How much in total has DHS recovered in the fraud that's been exposed?
Commissioner Gandhi.
So generally, year over year for the past 5 years, DHS recovers on average $18 million a year.
Okay, but really a fraction.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Schumacher. When you were before the Legislative Audit Commission, the ongoing numbers in fraud and abuse was much greater than that. And at that time, the discussion was that there was not efforts to recover that in full. And can you explain why there's no effort to recover that in full?
Commissioner Gandhi. Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacobs, I believe you're talking about the provider credit issue. And the credits result when we're sending out payments for claims that have been billed to DHS, and a lot of times those claims are adjusted. And so that results sometimes in a future claim being more if it's adjusted higher, or a future claim being less if it's adjusted lower. In some instances, after a credit is applied, say when it's adjusted less, some providers go out of business. There's multiple reasons why it's challenging to recover those overpayments. So these are not the result of fraud. They're the result of claims being adjusted over time. So that resulted, as the auditor mentioned, over time, it kind of building up over time to around $40 million. We did have some challenges in the department on, as folks left state service, some communications issues to which we discussed in the audit commission hearing. And we are working to resolve those. And we are, at this point, trying to move forward in a better steps and to go after those provider credits when it's feasible. In some instances, it's challenging to collect because the provider has left and they've gone out of business and there's nowhere to collect from. In fact, we had used an independent contractor for many years, a RAC audit, where they found that actually they were spending more money trying to collect than they were actually successful at. And so that's another challenge with these credits, is that in some instances we will be unable to get the funds back when, a business goes out of business. But we are taking steps to resolve the issue. We didn't have the correct steps in place at that time, and so we're looking to do better as an agency in that regard.
Representative Jacob.
Yes, specifically, what steps are you taking?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher and Representative Jacobs, I think clarifying across the department on who's responsible for what. In this instance, we had one area of the department, our healthcare administration, responsible for one aspect of sending out bills and sending out notices to providers, and another the area of the department collecting the finances or the actual claims. The credits kind of resulted in not an understanding of whose role and responsibility it was to do each step. So we have resolved that and have clearly indicated, okay, you're responsible for sending out the notices to providers, and on the other side of the department, you're responsible for collecting the claims.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah, Chair Schumacher, thank you. At the Legislative Audit Commission, I think we discussed that that's very possible. Sometimes it takes more money to recover the dollars that are lost than what you're going to recover. And at that time, I talked about being in that position as county commissioner and having to send out rebate checks and how much that cost. And it's just a matter of doing the right thing. So you're just saying, and I understand you don't consider it to be fraud when, but to the person paying the taxes and the money that's lost, it's going to feel like fraud, whatever the reason is that it happened. So are you saying you feel justified in not doing full recoveries if it's a break even, or doing the right thing might cost more than what it takes to recover those dollars?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative, we do think there is a threshold of the amount of claim that it is worth to expend resources. Say if it's a $5 underpayment, would we spend the resources to try to collect that if it's not collectible? Now, everyone we're sending out notices to and we're requesting all the funds back. But when it comes to the extra steps of trying to utilize staff resources and external contractors for, say, a $5 overpayment, that wouldn't make sense. So I can check with folks on what that threshold is and what we've defined, but that is one example where some are very, very low amounts, and, you know, we would expend many, many, many more resources to try to get that $5 back, for example.
Representative Jacob.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Commissioner, one of the things that we've heard consistently over the first couple weeks of the committee is from providers, from counties, about opportunities for efficiencies, trying to streamline operations, hopefully reducing costs, reducing burden on workers. One of the things I know has been talked about to help with that is the home and community-based portal to help streamline communication. Can you and your team provide us an update with the rollout of that portal?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Ms. A.C. Mers has the best information.
Assistant Commissioner Mers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, the HCBS, or Home and Community-Based Person Portal, was passed as a part of reform efforts on Waiver Reimagined back in 2019 or a little bit later. So that portal is designed to be an interface for people that use services to be able to go into a secure portal and access information about their services and supports to see, you know, how much their budget, if they have one of those, relative to their waivered benefits. So we are continuing to kind of work with our partners in Minute to gather our baseline requirements on that, and we are also working with an existing vendor to kind of figure out how those requirements map on to vendor capabilities. So we're making steady progress. I feel really positive about where we are in that process. I think one thing that I would note in terms of our approach to this is that we really, you know, the department, we really want to have, when this portal launches, to have it be kind of to start and to be in phased and iterative approach to adding functions and features that matter and make a difference for people. So our goal is really to launch something that is fairly basic for people to navigate and use, and then be working with members of the community and users over time through various focus group forums, other types of things, to be able to say, okay, now that you can log into the system, change your password, see X, Y, and Z, what's the next feature and function that's important to you? So I think we really think about this portal as something that isn't going to be fully complete on the day that it launches. It's going to be, again, sort of more of a simple interface, and then over time we'll figure out what is most important to add for people, how does that impact services and support, so that we're really improving it over time rather than trying to do everything all at once and have that take many, many years, which is, so that is where we are today, and I feel really excited about the possibility of getting better information into the hands of people so that they can also navigate their services and supports as they navigate many things these days in online secure portals.
Representative Norris.
Chair Schumacher, thank you. Do you have an anticipated launch date of even that basic functionality portal?
Assistant Commissioner Mers.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I can get that to you. It will be sometime before January 2027, hopefully up to 6 months before that, but we can get updated implementation timelines to make sure that we give you the very best information we have at our disposal today.
Representative Norris.
Thank you.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I had to go back and find all my notes, so I'm glad that we brought them back to have further conversation. So I want to pick up where I left off in the conversations, because we were talking about the reduction to the 351 days for the disability waivers. So I was in the process of asking. I know that right now we're taking a reduction. That's what is in the proposed, down to 351. So my first question is, how many days were we able to bill for prior to this change?
Who would like that? Director Bailey.
Yeah, Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler, 365 days.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director Bailey. So when I talk to my community, and I've talked to other communities too, not just CCRI, but other places, mathematically it doesn't make sense for them. And I know we've talked about it, and we'll probably have many more conversations about it making make sense. But what's coming to the top, what I'd like to talk through today, if we have a little bit of time to dive in, is the idea that we reduced the billable days by 2 weeks, and we increased the absence and utilization factor to 3.9. But mathematically, what our providers are saying is that we have individuals who don't go home for, you know, 14 days, or they're not capable of being able to go do some of the things that we're assuming through the agency they're able to do. So what my local organization and what other local organizations have brought to me is saying that if they have somebody who needs to utilize the 365 days worth of service, the 3.9% is a deficit for them. And so can you talk us through here how it makes sense in this proposal that it's a wash for them, that they're not losing money on an individual that would need the 365 days of service? And then I have a couple more questions after that.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler. Somebody, to be clear, the current rates have the 3.9 already. So we're already reimbursing providers for what the average costs are for that service, and then adding 3.9% on top of that to account for potential absences in which they cannot bill. This proposal will match how many days they can bill with that factor, so that it's equivalent. Essentially, we're increasing the rate so that you can still make ends meet according to times when you cannot bill. But we're also kind of limiting the billing days to align with that percentage. Otherwise, if we were not to have the 3.9% in there, they would be down that amount, and they could bill 365 and it would be a wash. I'm probably not articulating this correctly, but that's kind of the methodology. I think comparing to today, from today to if this were in effect, I mean, yes, they would lose revenue because right now we already have the 3.9% built into the rate, and we're putting in guidelines on billable days. So to that extent, I mean, to be clear, yes, providers would lose revenue compared to today, but we already have that absence factor built in, and so that's kind of the rationale for aligning billing requirements with what we're already increasing the rate to account for.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I just think we're going to have to lean into this a little bit more. I mean, and then hopefully we can have a resolve with this that really this is already an industry that they're taking hits on to provide the critical services that we need. And I really don't want that in my community. CCRI is our third largest employer, not only like what the services they provide, but this is a really big deal in my community. And so I would love the ongoing conversation about it. The second question I have, I didn't have before, but actually now I have, following up what Representative Jacobs said. So what you said is if an organization closes the doors and we're chasing them for money that they were overpaid, how do we make sure that that organization isn't able to like come back and be reapproved down the road for like another service provider without collecting the money that they were owed when they were like provider A in this lane? Do we have stop zones at least for that process?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler, that's a really great question. Unfortunately, I'm not that far into the weeds on how that works. My understanding is that we collect information when we enroll providers on who the controlling individuals are and connect the dots, but I would want to check with our folks that actually do the work and get back to you on that.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I love being in the weeds, right? Because I think that that's actually a really big thing that we should look at, because how do we know that the fraud actions are not happening by, oh, look, we have a profit that we banked and now we're going to close our business. And now in 2 years, we're going to come over and open a new provider option here. And then we're not crossing paths to make sure that they're not at least paying back or we're not recouping any of the billing that we paid out. So I would like us to explore that. And I don't know if it's this committee or what other committee we would need to look at. But I do think that we, because even if it's from this department and now they're going to go do something in education or they're going to go do something somewhere else, like I do think that we should get into the weeds on how we map that and protect our assets. So can I ask one more question, because that wasn't really on my list?
Representative Keeler.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. So I'm looking at the sheet that you gave us for anybody who still has them. On page 46, we talked about moving our behavior fund or our behavior health reform that we're moving. We used to provide a year's worth of services, and now we're only providing 60 days with the assumption that they'll be able to move to MA that quick. Are we sure that they would be able to move to MA that quick, or is there an option for them to have an extension while we're transitioning? Because we also don't want to create a gap in that service industry also.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schoenmaker, Representative Keeler, I believe in the proposal we have appeals processing and, you know, exceptions for folks that aren't eligible for MA. But I could get you more details on what our vision is for the process. We certainly would not want to leave people without coverage. Our goal is to, in this instance, to be smart on the state side, where if we have federal resources matching funds, let's shift them over to that resource in order to be good stewards of Minnesota's tax dollars. The other benefit would be, of course, on the Behavioral Health Fund, folks only have access to a very small number of services. However, most people have co-occurring conditions when they're seeking substance use treatment, so it's really important for them to access a comprehensive health care benefit.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I agree 100% with you. That's why I get nervous. I'm not worried about the individuals who aren't eligible for MA. I'm worried about the individuals who are eligible, but we know through history and the work that we've done and many conversations we've all had is that sometimes the process is slowed up, right? And so sometimes people who are eligible actually don't receive the services within 60 days, or there's like a gap there. And so I just want to make sure that on record we talk about the reality that there is a gap opportunity there. So when in that process would somebody create an appeal to say, I need to be extended further to make sure, right, that an MA eligible individual who's maybe the process is just taking longer, when would they be able to have an appeal for an extension?
Director Bailey. Director Bailey.
Yeah, Chair Schoenmaker, Representative Keeler, I'd love to work on this with you and make sure that, you know, the proposal adequately has some stopgaps in there to ease a transition. I think you're asking good questions, and we'll have to make sure that we sufficiently cover that.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. No more questions, but more just understanding that when we have really rural small communities, we utilize navigators to help us get enrolled in MA. And to be very, very clear, we don't have the same system that is in the 7-county metro. And so taking in mind that we in greater Minnesota and our rural communities are the communities that see the slower transition just because we don't have the massive amount of staff to do that. And so I just ask that you understand this process from a border-to-border perspective and making sure that when we look at how the common rollout happens is that we're not always leaning into the people who are in the backyard here, but actually people who are in the backyard of Minnesota. I am sure we'll have more conversations about it. It's just an area in this presentation that I have some concern about. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Gandhi, looking through the governor's recommendation, I did not see technology modernization fund. We've talked about how old the systems are in general. What's the plan for the agency as we see the separation that is happening between DCYF, DCT, and DHS? Are we looking to find resources so that we can have systems that are functional in today's age?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr. Yes, DHS has funding that it's received in the 2023 session for modernizing our systems, and various administrations have plans underway in collaboration with Minute. With the Technology Modernization Fund, there are proposals that are being created that will be sent to Minute for consideration to try to act quickly on, you know, the Technology Modernization Fund is designed to spur innovation and accomplish something in a quick spurt in a year or less for $1 million or less to get a jump on something. And so, yes, we have ideas underway that will be going to that fund for consideration.
Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need to really look into that. We haven't funded enough in terms of technology modernization. We invested in DCT in terms of electronic health record, which I think when they come before us, they'll have to explain how they have achieved their goals. But I'm really concerned about the systems that we have within DHS. The other question that I have, I'll skip some of the other ones. The CL, we're moving the customized living, you know, anyone who is under 55 will be excluded. What is the plan? Or are we planning to transition those individuals who are in the CL or applying to be in the customized living area if they're under 55? What's the plan, Assistant Commissioner Mertz?
Assistant Commissioner Mertz.
Chair Schumacher, Representative North, thanks for that question. So to clarify, the proposal limits access to customized living services for people 55 and younger for new recipients. So people currently receiving that service wouldn't be impacted. For new recipients or people coming into Medicaid, we would expect them to access different services under the disability waiver, if that's the waiver type they have, in order to get their needs met in the community.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Assistant Commissioner, is that not a shift because we're just moving them from one area to the other? Is there any cost savings between shifting them from customized living to the 245D or any other program?
Assistant Commissioner Mertz.
Chair Schumacher, Rep. Knorr, I think on the cost piece, I would defer to my colleague, Director Bailey, on any potential savings.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, the savings you'll see in the change page already account for any potential substitution effects with other services.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question is, we've talked about the housing stabilization. We've talked about the reforming how we do EIDBI. Are we coming with a plan to also address the housing stabilization and other programs that we've talked about?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, in our proposal, we have just funding at DHS, three FTEs for housing stabilization services, two to work on enrollment of both providers and people trying to access that service because we have about a three-month delay, but one FTE to work directly with providers to try to assist them and have resources on the front end. To, you know, work with them on designing or communicating kind of the requirements of the program and to bring to be able to be available to them with any questions that they have. You know, if this committee were interested in other ideas, I know the idea that Director Graham brought up on Steps for Success, that might be one area here that would be a good idea to work on related to these providers as well.
Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is something we really want to look into. Quite frankly, looking at the whole system-wide process, as I noted earlier on. One final question that I should have asked is the question about the rate exceptions and how that removing the counties from the conversation, how we can be able to reduce the cost in the waiver programs. So my question is, the shift that the counties have talked about when it comes to rate exceptions, how are we going to close that gap, and how are we going to be able to manage the rate exceptions within DHS?
Who would like that?
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr. I think our vision is to not cut out the counties in that process. Counties certainly play a pivotal role in that they're working directly with the person and the family, and they know from direct experience more than DHS would know on the level of acuity of the person and their needs. I think the goal of the proposal, however, is to put some guidelines around what kind of costs are eligible for a rate exception, and just kind of clear guidelines around, you know, the level of acuity a person should have to qualify for a rate exception. Lastly, we see renewals all the time from providers each year, and we need to have requirements in law that require documentation sent to DHS to ensure that if a provider is saying they need to pay somebody $25 an hour, say, instead of $20 that DWRS rate framework has in it, that we follow up the following year when they're requesting a new rate exception for the renewal, that they actually did pay those staff $25 an hour to make sure that we have some ability to have oversight and program integrity around the rate exceptions.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a lot of questions, and we cannot be done within the next 10 minutes, so I'll let other people ask the question. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, so to the commissioner or whomever wants to take these, do you follow the Minnesota DHS Twitter page, the employees?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen, I personally do not, although I think that it is important that DHS staff be aware of information that is available that comes to us either through tips, directly posted on Twitter. So I have our auditor and chief compliance officer reviewing it on a regular basis to determine if there's anything actionable.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I find a lot of things concerning that these employees are claiming, and unfortunately, they're quite afraid to come public. But one post, December 15th, says that DHS claims to delete emails older than a year, but the employees believe that's false and only to keep whistleblowers from accessing data. When court subpoenas DHS says it has no data emails, but in reality that DHS does not retain data on a separate, DHS does not retain data, but it's on a separate server and that the court is being lied to. And one of the most recent ones is that DHS uses tools that include surveillance of computers and communication devices to uncover whistleblowers. Those who report fraud will be under surveillance, including keystroke trackers, and hauled into investigations and threatened until staff quits. So, members, you know, I find the information that employees are giving to the public sphere extremely concerning. And I'm curious to know if these accusations are true. Do you in fact have a program in place that treats whistleblowers as if they are creating a crime themselves when in fact they are trying to be stewards of the taxpayer dollar?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen, no. I think that anybody that comes forward with a question or concern, complaint, that management and leadership need to treat that as a gift to look into something that is going on to determine whether there is anything that needs to be changed, if there are process improvements that need to be taken, if there are internal controls that need to be strengthened. As a former chief compliance officer, that's something that's just integral and a part of how I think an organization needs to run. So whistleblowers need to be protected, they need to be listened to, and we need to have fresh look at what they're saying to see if there are changes that need to be made.
Representative Franzen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in another post, this is just a week ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In another post, and this just was posted a week ago, the employees claim that April 2024, the lieutenant governor marched into a DHS public health conference to call fraud whistleblowers weirdos and losers in their parents' basements, and that whistleblowers were working against equity. And these are whistleblowers that are using a public sphere to be, you know, so that we don't know who they are, in order to protect their identity because they are fearful of coming forward. And I find that concerning that they have to use a method to get these messages out because they're afraid of being retaliated from within your department.
Point of order, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knorr.
I think we're talking about now the executive branch and some of that information. I appreciate that individuals are providing information online. I appreciate that it comes directly to the entities that are responsible for. You know, we've got the auditor's office. We've got, you know, staff within DHS. They have got a system. I used to work for DHS that you can report. And some of those things are tracked. And sometimes allegations that are posted online may not be true, to the sense that anybody can post anything. I appreciate that the employees are sharing that information, but sometimes I think when we talk about now the Lieutenant Governor and other people, I think this is now something else. So
Mr. Chair, we should
avoid bringing the executive branch to this conversation, and if there's any allegation, they need to bring it to us directly and we can address it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair, in this committee and other committees across the Capitol here, we do talk about an executive branch quite often. Unfortunately, apparently we are not allowed to talk about the Minnesota executive branch because the Minnesota Democrats are very concerned about what's happening in DC, and those conversations are constantly brought in. I am keeping it relative to Minnesota, and I think my comments are well warranted. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. Representative Hicks.
I'm taking us back to Representative Keeler's question, so I feel a little bit like I'm throwing us backwards. But is there any other program that has an absence factor baked in? So PCA, home-based ILS, you know, when people live in their own homes. Any other service that has an absence factor baked in, or is this a uniquely DWRS residential thing?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Hicks. All of the HCBS or all of the DWRS services do have an absence factor within the rate frameworks. I think what makes the residential unique is that it's where a person lives and it's a logical cap of 365 days possible. Whereas the other services under DWRS are unit-based services or day services where a person doesn't live there and there isn't a potential to go all the way up to a max of a certain amount. But yes, to answer your question, that there is an absence factor within all of the other DWRS services. PCA and CFSS also have a rate formula, but there is a kind of a muted effect to those factors just because we're not at full cost yet when it comes to the rate formula.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. That helps me better understand, so thank you so much for that. So all of our services have some absence factor baked into the rate, and none of these services can be billed unless they're provided, including our residential, correct? Okay, thank you. Just wanted to clarify.
Representative Hicks, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. This question is for the Commissioner. I'm going to just talk about CCAP a little bit. I know that we've touched on that before, but this is a big deal to be talking about right now. So what has happened with the new controls policies in regards to CCAP? And are programs currently under investigation still receiving funding? There was a news story that was just released the end of January. Currently, there are 62 investigations underway involving CCAP fraud, and we're talking to the tune of over $100 million. It's a lot of money, and I'm just curious, are these programs that are currently under investigation, do they still receive their funding? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, thank you for that question. I am still familiarizing myself with the numbers, but one of the challenges that I know is that stop payments are can be an extreme measure when you're still investigating. So our proposals this year are asking for intermediate, earlier interventions where we could pause payments while investigations take place. So in CCAP, we have currently, as you said, 62 open cases. Since 2020, our team has recovered $2.4 million, and we've stopped payments to 79 CCAP providers. So stop payment is a tool, but we would also like to add earlier tools, such as pausing payments or reviewing payments before the ability to stop or pause and review before payments are set out.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So what I hear you saying is currently those 62 investigations that are currently underway are still receiving state funding. Is that a yes, is what I'm hearing you say?
Commissioner Gunn.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, I would like to double check that because our investigation team has criteria about when they put stop payments in place. So I don't want to misspeak and tell you that we haven't done that if in some instances we have.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. This is very alarming. I mean, I can look back even back into 2017 and I believe 2018. There's been high alerts and big concerns about the potential of fraud and waste and abuse in this program. The fact that you are in the leadership role you're in, do I hear you saying that there needs to be a statute change in order for you to stop payment? Is that what I'm hearing?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, no, I am not saying that. What I'm saying is that stop payment is one tool, and we would like more tools that allow additional intervention for program integrity in many of our programs. So this year, the fraud package includes changes in authority, ability for earlier intervention, and other tools so that we can do more than we're able to do currently.
Thank you, Representative Gilman, for the final question there. Members, we are up against the clock. I do want to make one note on the governor's recommendation that we didn't get to talk about, and that was the nursing home funding piece. Just to put into the record that I think over the last 10 years, the legislature has made it very clear that the cost-based system is the system that we should be using to fund our nursing homes, and the 20% reduction to the inflation rate, I believe, undermines that effort. And in a time when the nursing homes are still struggling with the 18 to 21 month delay in payments and the efforts of the Workforce Standards Board and the parts that the governor does fund of that, it just exacerbates a problem that the legislature really for the last decade has been trying to avoid have happen. And so you're welcome to respond to that, or it was really just more of a comment than anything else. So we had that on the record too with the feedback, but I know we'll have more conversations about that over the next couple of months as well. So anything to conclude, a final word, Commissioner?
Chair Schumacher, I think we look forward to working with you on that nursing home issue, so.
Perfect. Members, thank you for your interest again today. We'll see you at 8:15 tomorrow morning. We are adjourned.